Northern Virginia Kitchen, Bath, and Basement versus Ellis. Peter M. Baskin, Appellant's Counsel. Peter Cohen, David Murphy, Appellee's Counsel.
All right. This is Justice Goodwin. I would note for the record that Chief Justice Lemons is not sitting on this matter, and that Senior Justice Millett is sitting in his stead. All right, you may proceed.
May it please the court, I am Peter Baskin, arguing this morning on behalf of Powell and Northern Virginia Kitchen, Bath, and Basement, who I'll collectively refer to as Powell. We're appealing for reversal of a judgment in favor of Mr. Ellis in the amount of $250,000, consisting of $100,000 in compensatory damages, $100,000 and $150,000 in punitive damages, awarded by a jury for claimed stalking and racially harassing words causing mental anguish to Mr. Ellis. That claimed stalking and harassment arose out of a one-time use of the N-word transmitted electronically by a voicemail from Powell to Ellis, who were co-workers at the time, and it was as a result of a business disagreement between them. It is our position that the stalking and harassment were argued to the jury, but not based on evidence from Mr. Ellis. The two bases for the appeal are there are no damages proven, mental anguish damage, and that his statements on cross-examination are conclusive of the controversy, and under the rule of Massey against Firmstone, should bar his judgment in his favor. The case is about words causing mental anguish damage, and Ellis's testimony is fatally flawed by his admissions on cross-examination, which went to the heart of the case. They were dispositive and conclusive of the controversy, and should not allow him to have judgment. The rule in Massey against Firmstone has numerous exceptions to it, and none of the exceptions apply to Mr. Ellis's testimony, and therefore he falls within the rule, and that rule is he can rise no higher than his own evidence. And throughout
counsel, this is Justice Kelsey. May I interrupt you? What exactly did Mr. Ellis say that irrefutably contradicted his claim of having true mental anguish? What literally did he say that rendered it impossible for him to genuinely and truthfully have mental anguish?
When he was asked if the language of Mr. Powell caused him to bring the suit, his answer, as found in the appendix, was no. I brought this suit because he involved me in a case that I had nothing to do with, and so I filed a counterclaim against him.
How does that statement refute the fact that he had mental anguish? Okay, he didn't want to bring a lawsuit. So what? That doesn't mean he didn't have mental anguish. It means he didn't want the additional compounding hassle of bringing a lawsuit.
But it also says that he what he did was not as a result of the words or language used. If I've answered your question, I'd like to move on. If I haven't, I'm happy to try again.
But, no, you should move on.
Okay. In our view, if cross-examination is to have continued viability and be an important mechanism in the truth-finding process, then what he said on cross-examination is fatal to his case. He said things like, I just wanted this to blow over, I just wanted to get past it. He didn't do anything about it when he was specifically asked a long series of questions about did he seek any counseling, did he seek any assistance from anyone, the courts, the police, or anyone. He was very dismissive and said, no, he didn't. And that does not speak of mental anguish or mental suffering. His statement that the words weren't the reason for his suit, which, by the way, his pleading doesn't even mention the words harassment or stalking or intimidation or anything of the sort. So his language is not within any exception to the rule of Massey against Firmstone, and conclusively bars his claim. He cannot rise above that statement. I didn't do anything as a result of these words. It was only when I was sued that I sued in return. And that is his statement above which he can't rise. That's not an opinion. That's not in isolation to anything else in his testimony. It was his words and not our appellant's interpretation of his words. It is not isolated from his testimony. It was the culmination of a recurring theme in his cross-examination evidence. And the judge, during the motion to strike, even said so in response to counsel's reply to the appellant's argument on the motion to strike. The judge said, there's no testimony at all here on the question of compensatory or monetary damages. There was no evidence at all. And what's important about that statement is the spontaneity of it. It was a spontaneous statement of the judge that came right at the end of the evidence. The evidence concluded. Mr. Ellis rested. We addressed a motion to strike to the court. And as soon as counsel for Mr. Ellis began to reply to our motion to strike at the end of the evidence, that's what the trial judge said. There is no testimony at all. And how the case went further is just inexplicable to me, because that statement is very telling. When the trial judge, who had just heard the evidence, said to counsel for Mr. Ellis, there was no testimony at all on the subject. And that being the case, that should be the view of this court as well on review of this case. There was no evidence out of the mouth of Mr. Ellis expressing mental anguish, torment, or anything of the sort. He was dismissive of the whole thing. I just wanted it to blow over. I didn't call the police. And it culminated in that statement when I asked him. So on the basis of language, you brought this suit? And he said, no, it wasn't on the basis of language. That flaw in his acknowledgement that he had no case. And we're asking the court to set aside this judgment and enter judgment for Powell and a kitchen, bath, and basement. Unless you have further questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of the time for rebuttal.
All right, you have 7 minutes and 22 seconds. Counsel?
Good morning, afternoon. May it please the court. David E. Murphy on behalf of the appellee, William Ellis. This case is about two very narrow assignments of error. Did the trial court err in denying the appellant's motions to strike the compensatory damages evidence and post-trial motion to strike the verdict on the same basis? In an even narrower assignment of error, did the trial court err in denying the appellant's same motions for punitive damages solely on the argument if there was no evidence of compensatory damages? The trial court's rulings here should be affirmed for three reasons. First, Mr. Ellis's testimony on the damages he suffered, combined with the appellant's racially motivated and threatening communications causing those damages, was more than sufficient to support the damages verdict. Second, it was not error for the trial court to deny the motions and to permit the damages to go to the jury based on that evidence. Third, and critically, this is simply not a Massey case, as Mr. Ellis never contradicted himself during his testimony, as woven into Justice Kelsey's question earlier. Mr. Ellis occupies the most favored position in law. All conflicts of evidence and testimony are settled in his favor, and he is entitled to all just inferences from that testimony. Now, at trial, Mr. Ellis testified extensively to the damages he suffered, and the appellant's reply brief recognizes this. When on page 4 and 5, they say the case at bar is about words causing mental anguish, and the case is about Mr. Ellis's state of mind. That was exactly Mr. Ellis's theory in the pleadings at trial, now on this appeal, and it's exactly why the evidence supports the damages. Compensatory damages includes insult, pain, and mental suffering, and there is no exact method to quantify those damages. And it is not reversible error unless it is, quote, conclusively apparent that the plaintiff proved no cause of action and the verdict is without any evidence to support it. And the statutory causes of action here explicitly mention damages. In particular, the stalking statute explicitly states that the damages are for all of the defendant's acts prohibited by the statute.
Counsel, may I interrupt you with a question? Am I right that the issue before us, brought to us by the appellant, is whether or not compensatory damages can be awarded at all, as opposed to, it can be awarded, but this is too much?
That's correct. That's my understanding of the narrow assignments of error, Your Honor. There's no argument or assignment of error or appeal about the amount of damages or whether they were excessive. It's solely about, was there evidence to support compensatory damages? And those were the assignments of.
We don't have to get into any debate with this case as to the quantum of damages as being a little high with these fact patterns or a little low with these fact patterns or anything like that. We just need to know, was there a sufficient prima facie case of compensatory damages? And if yes, obviously that's a predicate for punitives. Am I constructing the issue correctly?
Exactly, Your Honor. Those are the very narrow assignments of error chosen by the appellants. So all we're here is, can the evidence support basically any compensatory damages verdict? Now, before Mr. Ellis testified on damages, the appellants had bragged to him that he whooped a black man in prison and was the president of a motorcycle gang. Now, the dispute developed over working at this third-party residence, and the appellants called Mr. Ellis working on this house an N-word move and a bad move. The appellants further threatened, "This ain't gonna work out good for you, buddy. We don't play that shit down here in Virginia, boy. You better get your shit straight. I'd better not see you over there." There is no dispute this was about Mr. Ellis's race, because again, in the appellant's own words, he said, "You pulled the same shit on me that fucking black people around here do. I guess they're all the same down there. And let me tell you, you ruined it for the next black man." Now, the threats then escalated. "If I were you, I wouldn't go nowhere near working on that house. I'm going to make sure you don't get that job." And then critically, back to the earlier testimony, "I've got motorcycle clubs and gangs around here. You're in the wrong part of town to be playing that dirty shit you pulled on me. You're a dirty motherfucker, and that's a wrong move." But the appellants continued by texting Mr. Ellis, "You're a dirty person. I know how to get you to call me. You need to check on what Leesburg is about, and what goes around comes around." Now, all of those threats laid the predicate for Mr. Ellis's damages, and everything I'm about to read is a direct quote from Mr. Ellis at trial. "I was kind of scared. I was upset. My thought was he was going to try to just do something to hurt me. He threatened me that he was going to do something to me. He threatened me with motorcycle gangs and clubs, and when a man says something, my belief is that he will really follow through with it. Also, for a period of time, every time I go down the road, I see a motorcycle. I have a nervous feeling come across, and I had to watch them till I get out of sight." Mr. Ellis also testified, "I didn't drive at night." And he also told two other people about his fear, Sally Coffey and his sister, who he was currently living with. Now, opposing counsel and the appellants make an argument that this is all the product of counsel. But the most direct evidence of Mr. Ellis's damages was on cross-examination. The appellants asked Mr. Ellis if he felt intimidated, harassed, or threatened by the conduct. Mr. Ellis responded yes to all three questions. The appellants asked how Mr. Ellis was threatened. Mr. Ellis responded, "By telling me not to go to this job, and he got motorcycle clubs and gangs around here." The appellants also asked Mr. Ellis if he indicated he was nervous all the time before he went back to Mississippi. Mr. Ellis responded yes. They also asked him, and Mr. Ellis testified on cross-examination, he never knew if Mr. Powell was looking around the corner or not, and this led him to install security cameras on the door of his sister's house due to his fear of the appellants. Now, I'm about to get into Massey, which is the core of the appellant's appeal, but very briefly, in Schnupp v. Smith, Very similar situation. This court held Smith detailed for the jury how he felt about being falsely accused of involvement in a drug transaction, and the court then instructed the jury on insult, pain, embarrassment, humiliation, and mental suffering, exactly as in this case. Mr. Ellis detailed for the jury how he felt about the conduct and the fear, inconvenience, insult, and mental suffering it caused to his personal and vocational daily life and work. The appellants apparently agree because in their brief they wrote, quote, such damages can only be proven by the words of the person experiencing that kind of damage, words out of the mouth of that person. As just summarized, that is exactly what Mr. Ellis testified to at trial. Also very briefly, in Johnson v. Hugo Skateway, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals analyzed the same racial harassment statute and said that and was faced with an argument like this, that the appellants tried to prevail by focusing on discrete and isolated portions of testimony, exactly as occurring here. The Fourth Circuit rejected it, said that Johnson testified he felt intimidated, and the jury was then free to weigh this testimony in light of all the other testimony, exactly as happened in this case. Now, for all of those reasons, and as pointed out by Justice Kelsey's question, this is not a mass. First, this Massey argument was raised for the first time on appeal. Massey was never mentioned in a motion to strike or a motion to set aside the verdict. But second, importantly, the testimony at issue does not trigger Massey because there is no conflicting testimony. The Massey doctrine must be applied in the context of the litigant's entire testimony, and an adverse statement by a litigant standing in isolation from the rest of the testimony will not trigger Massey preclusion. Now, all of the cases cited by the appellants, as well as other Massey cases by this court, reveal that this is not a Massey case. In Massey, Mr. Massey claimed he was owed a commission, but he wrote letters acknowledging he would only earn the commission if there was an actual sale. He testified there was no sale, so the Massey doctrine was created. Then in Holland, the plaintiff unequivocally testified the accident was not the fault of her husband, who she was suing. Therefore, her testimony absolved her husband of any wrongdoing. Dial v. Deskins, the plaintiff first testified he was told certain streets would be paved when he bought the property, but later testified that street paving was not one of the terms or conditions of the purchase, there was no contract for paving, he would have purchased the property regardless of the paving, and he purchased the property without any inducement related to the paving. Fraser v. Stout, the plaintiff testified of a bunch of details about a car striking her, including when she stepped off the concrete that the car was very close to her. Now, that was a concurring negligence case that isn't directly applicable to this case, but the court held based on that testimony, there was no dispute she was guilty of concurring negligence. Finally, in Travis v. Bufalin, the dispute was over whether a contract was either fixed price or an oral cost 5%+ contract. The court held that Travis was a stop from claiming a fixed price contract because he signed a memorandum that changed it to that cost plus 5% contract, and then he even testified he signed the memorandum. Finally, in another case from this court in 1985, CSX Transportation Viscasali, which was not on brief, this involved the plaintiff's ability to work. And the court held it could not disregard the plaintiff's earlier testimony because he was working at the time of the second trial and report to a new job that next week. Now, none of Mr. Ellis's testimony, as summarized before, reveals anything close to a Massey issue. He made no unequivocal admissions of facts that would show conclusively he suffered no damages. Now, if Mr. Ellis had responded to those questions on cross-examination, no, I didn't suffer emotional distress or pain or mental anguish, or fear, or intimidation, but then had earlier or later testified he did, that would be a Massey issue. But that never occurred, and it's not even argued directly in the appellant's brief. In fact, counsel mentions the pleading and that was never mentioned. That's a complete misstatement. Mr. Ellis pled exactly that Powell left two voicemails intending to intimidate him and place him in fear of his physical safety and to humiliate him as a black person. And that upon hearing the voicemails, he became extremely nervous and distraught and feared for his safety. That's paragraphs 26 and 27, which is also in the joint appendix. Then Mr. Ellis pled that the appellant's conduct injured him, including emotional and mental anguish. So Mr. Ellis was entirely consistent from pleading the counterclaim up through right now at this appeal. Now, the appellants focus on a statement of, no, I filed the claim because he involved me in a lawsuit I had nothing to do with. But as pointed out by Justice Kelsey's question, this testimony has nothing to do with damages. By the time the counterclaim was filed on November 9th, 2017, Mr. Ellis had been suffering the damages he testified about since July. And additionally, the legal act of bringing a counterclaim is wholly distinct from damages suffered as a result of conduct. Appellants also don't cite Mr. Ellis' testimony immediately following this exchange, where they asked him if he heard other racist language in other contexts and why he didn't bring a lawsuit, and Mr. Ellis responded, most of the words weren't directed towards me, he just heard them. Well, the appellant's words were indisputably directed at Mr. Ellis because of his race. The appellants also focus on the testimony, I tried to leave it alone so it would blow away, it would just blow over. But Mr. Ellis was afraid of the appellants, and he tried to leave it alone. But the appellants kept sending him racially motivated threats and stalking him, even after he asked not to be called anymore. Mr. Ellis not calling the police or not knowing Virginia had this racial harassment statute has nothing to do with his damages. And about calling the police, that theory was sent to the jury. They brought that testimony out, and by their verdict, the jury rejected it. That is not reversible error. And so, in summary, the appellants are requesting that the court view the evidence in the light most unfavorable to Mr. Ellis, exactly the opposite of the standard in this case. In Shepard v. Capital Foundry, this court held that the circuit court failed to view the evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff and erred in its determination that the verdict was excessive. So slightly different appeal, but generally the same. And that the trial court had limited its review of the evidence which were adverse to the plaintiff and viewed it in the light most unfavorable to the plaintiff, which this court held was error. Now, two other cases from this court that also involved Massey and Robinson v. Copeland, an unpublished decision from this court in 2017, the court discussed Massey and overruled the trial court because it decided material facts genuinely in dispute in favor of the defendant and that was a matter for the jury. It's exactly what the appellants are trying to do here. Also, in 2005, this court decided Bussey versus ESC Restaurants and held that the testimony did not directly conflict, so it created a jury issue regarding the weight to be given to the testimony. Again, that's exactly what the appellants are trying to do here. Very briefly on punitive damages, as Justice Kelsey's question pointed out, this is not about sufficiency of punitive damages, and if the court upholds the trial court's determination or the jury's determination as formalized by the trial court in its rulings on the motions on compensatory damages, that fully disposes of the appeal as to punitive damages. But as briefed and to the extent the court has questions, Mr. Ellis absolutely met the standard for punitive damages. Finally, the appellants argue that Mr. Ellis never sought medical treatment. They have never cited any law supporting this argument, nor is there any. And finally, the appellants have been misstating the trial court's comments during these motions in every brief at the trial court, at the appeal, and now during this oral argument. The trial court never commented that there was no evidence of compensatory damages. They were focused on lack of financial damages and then realized that was not Mr. Ellis's theory and denied the motions. I've used all my time, but if the court has any questions, I'm prepared to answer them.
All right. Rebuttal?
May it please the court. In rebuttal, just let me say that the quotation from the judge is exact and is accurate. She said, I'm struggling with the compensatory and monetary issue because there is no testimony at all. That's an exact quote from the judge right out of the transcript, and it's in the appendix, which is a part of the paperwork in this case. The language of Mr. Powell was uttered one time. It was not, and it's set out in the brief, and all other communication, and there was only two or three electronic communications afterwards, were completely of a different tone. So it was not a continuous, ongoing tirade as characterized by counsel's argument. None of the following statements were explained on redirect examination by Mr. Ellis. His mental state was as follows. I just wanted to blow over. I thought it would go.
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey. Can you point me to the page in the joint appendix where the trial judge made the statement that you have been referring to? What page is that in the joint appendix?
Let me look. Give me a moment and I'll have it for you because I know exactly where it is. Yes, it's found on page 79 of the appendix, starting at line 11. The counsel for Ellis was arguing to the court in response to Powell's motion to strike. And at line 11, the court said, if you can get past nominal or compensatory damages, then certainly it can go to the jury on punitive. I'm struggling with, based on the argument of counsel, I think she was referring to Powell's counsel, how you get past compensatory or monetary because there was no testimony at all. That is the language of the court.
But the language continues because I'm looking at your prayer for relief and it's all economic, monetary, pecuniary, compensatory, and non-compensatory damages, including emotional distress and mental anguish. So why would the trial court send this to the jury if the trial court was saying there is absolutely zero evidence of any compensatory damage? It seems as though what the trial court's saying is there's no evidence of pecuniary damage or economic damage, which and apparently there is none.
Correct. And there is also no mental damage out of the mouth of Mr. Ellis. He just didn't want to have any dealings anymore with Mr. Powell, and he didn't. The evidence is clear. Other than this one time electronically transmitted communication, a voicemail, there was no further communication between them. There was no conduct, no interaction, and verbally or otherwise. Okay. His further language above which he can't rise, which is not in isolation, not opinions, these are factual matters that he testified to. Because the only way we can know about what's in a person's mind is what they say is in their mind. And this is what he had to say. I just don't want to have any dealings with him on an appendix at page 46. Then he involved me in a lawsuit I had nothing to do with at appendix 58 and 63. Okay. He wouldn't know any of Powell's associates. One of the centerpieces of this mental anguish was Mr. Ellis's alleged fear of seeing motorcycles go up and down the road, which we feel is a little strained. But in any event, he also said at page 65 of the appendix, he wouldn't know any of Powell's motorcycle associates if he saw them. So for him to say he was in fear of them is not logical, okay? I didn't sue over the language. I sued him because he sued me. That's the gist of his comment. And when that's exactly what his exact words were. He involved me in a lawsuit I had nothing to do with, so I filed a counterclaim. And that is conclusive of the controversy, and the controversy is what his mental state is. And his mental state is more less anguish and more anger at being sued. And when that happens, when you make statements like that under Massey against Firmstone, they...
Counsel?
Yes.
Counsel? This is yes. Justice Mims.
Yes, sir.
I wasn't going to comment, but his mental state, it seems to me, was, I'm not going to be the aggressor here. I'm going to just mind my own business. But once you force me into court, I'm going to go ahead and seek to have my rights vindicated. Now, how is that statement that I just made not a reasonable inference from the testimony?
Because it is preceded by the question or his answer to the question of counsel on cross-examination, me. Did you sue over the language? And the centerpiece of his case is, I'm upset by this language. I'm mentally upset. I'm tortured. I'm anguished by this language. And he was asked directly, did the language cause you to bring your suit? And he said, no, it was something else. So
because counsel, he didn't, is he counsel, was not he didn't bring a suit. Counsel, he did not bring a suit. He brought a counterclaim.
Yes, correct.
He was backed into a corner and finally said, enough is enough. Now I'm going to go ahead and seek to have my rights vindicated. Well, and that's not a question. You don't have to respond. That's simply a statement by me.
But I think as a matter of historic fact in the case, where Powell originally brought against Mrs. Coffey, that's the lady who he had the business problem with, and Mr. Ellis and Mr. Powell were co-workers on that project. I lost my train of thought. She is the one who, she is the one that settled her lawsuit with Mr. Powell, or he settled it with her, and this counterclaim laid out there tangentially, and then it was proceeded upon. It was not like an intentional leaving Alice's counterclaim out there. And why they decided to resurrect it, I can only speculate on. But
counsel, your time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll be in touch with you all soon.
Thank you.
Take care. Court is adjourned until tomorrow morning at 9 a.m.